The North American International Auto Show in Detroit opens to the public this weekend. It's often a showcase for new technology. As NPR's Sonari Glinton reports, many car companies are rolling out features that bring us closer to the ultimate in automotive tech, cars that drive themselves.
When you watch science fiction movies, you'll notice there are two things it seems like we'll get in the future. At some point, we'll all switch to that one silver jumpsuit, and our cars will drive themselves.
Manual override engaged.
In the movie iRobot, which is set in 2035, Will Smith is sitting in the driver's side of his Audi, relaxing and reading a magazine. Then he gets attacked by robots.
You are experiencing a car accident.
The hell I am!
From iRobot, I think we're a couple decades.
Philip Rabick is with Audi. Now, Audi is the first car company to test driverless cars in Nevada. Now, Google has been working on this for years with actual self-driving cars on the road. But Google is a tech company, not a car company, yet. Rabick says Audi is getting in on the game because they already have most of the building blocks for driverless cars.
Adaptive cruise control, which now has a stop-and-go feature. We have a lane departure warning. We have a lane change warning. So we have a lot of systems inside the car that are sort of headed in the direction of assisting the driver.
Rabick says the company is moving towards the next step, getting all those features to talk to each other. Audi is working on eliminating some of the most mundane driving tasks, like parking.
You come to a valet situation, you get out of your car, you push a button on your smartphone, and then the car will basically go by itself into a parking structure. It will find a parking spot and it will park itself.
That technology is here right now and is likely to be available in just a few short years. But what's keeping all the cool stuff away from us? Well, we are. For instance, Toyota, like many car companies, has adaptive cruise control. It allows you to follow at a safe distance in traffic without using the brakes or gas. Brian Lyons is with Toyota.
I've driven it. It is very, very hard not to touch the gas pedal and not to touch the brake pedal.
Lyons says most of us will have a hard time giving up control, but he says Toyota is working on technology that you won't necessarily notice when driving. The key is to make driving easier and safer.
The first autonomous driving feature was anti-lock brakes. So what it did is it stopped us from skidding in slippery conditions, right? So there's 1,000 times a second it's pulsing the brakes for you. Things that we as a human cannot even do, the car can do for us.
That's the kind of stuff Toyota is working on. Toyota is advancing systems to keep you from hitting objects or infrared cameras that allow the car to see much further down the road or sense when other cars are or aren't braking. Jeremy Anwell is with Edmunds.com. He says in the coming years, we're going to do less and less driving, and our cars are going to do more and more of the mundane, predictable tasks.
But what about the unpredictable? And this is where human beings still have an advantage over technology and computers, is that we deal with ambiguity or unexpected situations much better than machines.
Amel says in the coming years, our insurance and legal systems are going to have to work out the questions of liability.
To make driverless cars really work, every car needs to be driverless and they all need to be communicating so that they can sort of parse, hey, we're coming to an intersection, who's going to go first and who's going to brake? And you need sort of rules and technology that can enforce that. It doesn't work too well when you're the only driverless car on the road and nobody else has that technology.
Every car exec I've talked to says the switch will take at least 30 years. Now, that's the bad news. The good news, those scary robots, they'll have to wait too. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Flora Lichtman, filling in for Ira Flato today. Solar, wind, geothermal. Now there's a new renewable energy source to add to that list. It's free, completely reliable, and totally unlimited. The force of gravity. Two British designers have invented a lamp that runs on gravity alone. Their Gravity Light, yes, that's its name, aptly named, uses, you guessed it, the pull of gravity on a weight to generate up to 30 minutes of light. To turn the lamp on, you lift a weighted bag up, and voila, as the bag slowly descends, LED illumination. So how does this work? How hard is it to make? My next guest is here to tell us. Martin Ridderford is one of the inventors of the Gravity Light and founder of the design company Therefore. He joins me by phone from London, England. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Flora.
Hi. Tell us what this gravity light looks like, and then take us under the hood and tell us how it works.
Okay, so gravity light is a project which we started because we were working with a charity trying to find an alternative to kerosene lamps for the developing world. And we were working with solar power at the time, and we were doing a lamp which used LED bulbs and a battery, and you had to charge it through solar panels. And we found out that the cost of the unit was too expensive for people in Africa to buy, because they have very, very limited finances, and there's no microfinancing in Africa. So the lowest possible BOM cost or purchase cost was absolutely essential in the project. So we came out of a meeting when we'd presented our the latest work we'd done with the battery-powered device, and thought we've got to find a cheaper way of doing this.
Now, how did you come up with the idea of – how did gravity come to mind?
Well, we realized that there were two components, the LED and the battery, and obviously the means of charging it. And there are various means of charging devices like this with hand cranks and things like that. But they generally always involve a battery. And we were trying to think of a way of getting rid of the battery, and this is where the gravity side came in. So we envisaged this this scenario where you lift a weight, as you say, the heaviest weight you can lift, about 10 kilograms or 20 pounds, as high as you can lift it, about 6 foot, and then you let it go, and this device releases the bag very slowly and powers a generator to create a very small amount of electricity, but enough electricity to give you sufficient light. Well, more light than a kerosene lamp would give you.
So no battery required. It's just a teeny tiny generator.
Exactly.
Hmm.
And that's one of the interesting things, because not only can it create light, obviously, but because it's a generator, we can potentially charge batteries and things like that, but in a very, very, very slowly. Which is important to realize. This isn't a way of generating large amounts of electricity, but because the developments of LEDs and electronics make power consumption less and less over time, then this kind of project becomes more and more worthwhile, because we can do more and more with the small amount of power that we create.
And how much power are you creating?
Well, we called the project DeciWatt, which basically tells you how much power it's creating. So,
so a tenth of a watt, then, is that right? Just for people who forget.
A tenth of a watt, yes. So depending on how fast you let the weight travel down, depends on how much energy you get out of it. So the prototypes that we built generate between 30 milliwatts and half a watt, and we've got a variable drive on the end which allows us to change from the very low power condition where we're just able to light an LED and use it as a night light kind of thing, and then we can, as I say, generate half a watt for more of the sort of battery charging things that we're experimenting with.
Oh, I guess, or bright lights. It's like a built-in dimmer.
Sort of thing, yeah. One of the things that we discovered fairly early on was that the whole rig is a bit counterintuitive. So if you were imagining that you were going to increase the heat on a fire, you'd chuck another log on, and you'd expect the log to last longer and also to give you more heat. The trouble with the gravity light is that if you put more weight on it, it descends faster, so it lasts less time, but it doesn't necessarily light the LED much lighter, because it's all about the efficiency curve of the LED.
So it's hard to scale up. You're not going to run a toaster off of this if you have a really heavy light, necessarily.
No, it's really suited at this kind of deciwatt range. I mean, lots of people have said, "Oh, yeah, I want to hang it from my third story." But the other part of what we're trying to do here, which is what makes it interesting, is that other systems, like a hand-cranked torch or whatever, requires the user to invest quite a lot of time in doing the rewinding. So the joy of this system is that one very swift operation, 3 seconds or so, gives you 30 minutes of light. So there's a big payback for a very short period.
How much does it cost to make?
Well, currently, our costings for the first prototype at about 5,000 units is about $6.50. But we've got various a couple of bearings in there that we hope to not need in the future. We're obviously not using much buying power in terms of buying the LED and the motor. So what we're trying to do is to trial 1,000 of these units in Africa and get all the feedback we can from how people use them, how high they hang them, how much light they need, do they have it turned to the dimmest or the brightest, what else they want to do with it. We put a couple of terminals on the outside as a sort of open source hacking kind of facility so that you can attach other things to it. So you can attach, for instance, a radio to it and run a radio perfectly satisfactorily from it. You can attach a task light from it and use it for sort of desk reading. And as I say, you can charge batteries from it. So the part of the trial that we're planning on doing in the next 6 months, we're going to build some of these accessories and give them to people and find out how they use them and how they get on.
You know, I know this is meant as a way to replace kerosene lamps, but I can imagine a market here where electricity is available, too. Have you ever thought of doing something like the Tom's model, the Tom's shoes, where you buy one and they donate a pair as well?
Well, interestingly, we've been developing this for a number of years as a sort of Skunk Works project after we did this project with our charity. And we got to a point where we've got these prototypes working and we want to tool up and make enough units to go and distribute around the world to get this feedback that we need. And we decided to use a crowdfunding campaign to do that, and we had terrific success there. So over a period of a month or so, we've raised hundreds of thousands of dollars, which enables us to pay for the tooling, but also to do research and other things with it. But the other side of crowdfunding, which is wonderful, is that we've connected with a whole bunch of people around the world. Firstly, a whole bunch of really generous Americans that American people have probably account for 50% of the funders for our enterprise. And then we've connected with a whole bunch of people in developing countries who are wanting to distribute or help us do this research or their charities or whatever. So we've got a really good spread of contacts through this. And a number of the American people who've funded us have said, well, you know, we live in the in Canada Northern America, and we've got... we do a lot of outdoor stuff. We'd love one of these, for camping or in our hut or whatever in the wilderness. So we're going to send a whole bunch of units out to people and see what happens. So, the crowdfunding thing that I was talking about, we did a buy one for yourself and then gift one for this trial. So and that's the way that we would probably sell it in the West, is to do exactly that kind of thing, which I think people buy into very well.
Is your design company working on any other gravity power applications?
Well, we're currently, because now we've got the funding to do it, we're exploring lots of other opportunities, and we've got this internal development group who are currently looking at where those opportunities might take us. And we have a sort of an ambition that that we could potentially have a battery-less system for getting on the internet. But it's obviously a long shot, and we need to do the research to find out whether we can do that within the power budget that we have. But the notion is that we could. One of our clients is Inmarsat, who do stationary satellites, and we want to try and engage with them to see whether we can do a receiver for broadcast satellite information, which runs at this kind of very low level. And if we can, then it would be great to imagine that we could, say, download a Wikipedia page with a device without batteries. So that's a long-term goal, which may or may not be achievable, but it's, you know, we're setting our sights high.
Absolutely. It's exciting to think about. Well, good luck to you.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you for coming on. Martin Ridderford is the founder of the design company Therefore and one of the inventors of the Gravity Light. Stay with us because our next segment is something that I think is on the minds of many people this season. It's the flu virus. We're talking about its preferred habitat, how it travels, and how to outsmart it. Stay with us.
Now, if you own an electric car, like, say, the Nissan Leaf, and you use an electric vehicle charger, well, here's something you might not know. That charger may have been made by the same company that makes drones, the unmanned aircraft used by our military. The company is called AeroVironment. It's based outside Los Angeles. It is a firm with a strange combination of specialties, and NPR's Amy Walters says that has a lot to do with its creator.
Paul McCready loved things that fly.
As a youngster, I was very interested in model airplanes, ornithopters, autogyros, helicopters, gliders, power planes.
McCready passed away in 2007. That was from a speech he made at a TED conference in 2003. But as obsessed as he was with flying things, McCready never wanted to break the sound barrier like Chuck Yeager or buzz the control tower like Maverick in Top Gun. He loved nature, and McCready's dream was to create birds, or recreate them. He founded AeroVironment in 1971. His designs were very light and flew incredibly slow, with just enough power to stay aloft. But passion and interest don't always make money, and McCready found himself in debt to the tune of $100,000.
And I noticed that the Kramer Prize for human-powered flight was 50,000 pounds, which at the exchange rate was just about $100,000. So suddenly I was interested in human-powered flight.
The result was the Gossamer Condor.
The only obstacle left is the 10-foot finish pole.
A pilot pedaled McCready's ultralight plane through the air. Paul McCready won the prize. That first human-powered plane led to solar power planes. The planes led to cars, but the evolution was far from linear.
Ready?
Launching.
Enter the Raven, an AeroVironment drone. That's what you're hearing right now. You'll notice the company's fondness for ornithological nomenclature. Sergeant Michael Susted trained on the Raven in Afghanistan. It's so small, you can launch it with your bare hand.
It has cameras, GPS, so that when it comes back, we can brief our commanders what's going on at that location.
You might want to step back, sir, because I'm going to plug the charge cable in.
Roger Corey is a senior electronics engineer with AeroVironment in California.
The only sound that it will make will be a high-pitched whining. It sounds like somebody's whistling to a dog.
Corey's testing AeroVironment's other specialty, electric vehicle charging stations, made to line U.S. highways. The difference between his company's products doesn't escape him.
One flies and the other doesn't.
The core technologies are the same, though, and that means engineering staff can move from one side of the company to the other, and Department of Defense contracts pick up the tab for all kinds of new research and development, including the Switchblade, the first handheld drone that spies and shoots. When production began, Tim Conver, the company's current president, says he had to sit the staff down for for a little talk.
And I think a lot of individuals that initially were a little taken back, what are we doing making weapon systems, either got comfortable with it or in some cases said, you know, I don't want to work on that program. I'm fine with us doing it, but I don't want to work on it myself. No problem.
When I asked Converse if the company had drifted from its beginnings, he said no.
I understand that it's conventional wisdom that you have defense and you've got environment here. But as you can see, I don't see any inherent conflict.
Drones make up over 3/4 of AeroVironment's revenue, and the industry is moving at a quick pace, with over 4% growth projected over the next 10 years. The future of AeroVironment's electric vehicle charger business is less predictable. That will depend on U.S. demand for electric cars. Amy Walters, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. We start things off today with our quick look ahead to the week in tech. First up, Kim.com, founder of the file hosting service Mega Upload, is back in the news. Last year, the U.S. Justice Department charged the New Zealand resident with online copyright infringement, but that hasn't stopped him from launching a new website just last night. It's called simply Mega. Here's NPR technology correspondent Laura Seidel.
And this site will let people store 50 gigabytes of stuff for free in the cloud.
That stuff includes photos, music, and videos.
So, you know, there are services. What he's doing is he's getting into the market of services like Dropbox, which lets you, for example, if you have a big file to send to somebody of a whole bunch of pictures or video or a huge amount of documents, instead of emailing it to them, you can just send them a note and say, go to Dropbox and store the file there, and then they can download it.
But Mega's 50 gigabytes of free storage is more space than services such as Dropbox currently offer. Kim.com tweeted that Mega had received 250,000 user registrations within just a few hours of the site's launch. Also in our tech look ahead, a note on what Facebook calls its new Graph Search. It's a tool that will allow users to search for, say, a restaurant and show results based on their friends' preferences.
Search is incredibly important, and if you add sort of social relationships to search, you can get results that might be more meaningful to you than they would be if you're just doing a random search.
The new feature was unveiled last Tuesday and starts rolling out to the public this week. And that's our look ahead to the week in tech news with NPR's Laura Seidel.
And we have some tech news now to mark today's inauguration. The Presidential Inaugural Committee recently released a smartphone app to help people follow the day's events in real time. It has maps of the parade route, volunteer opportunities, and real-time updates. As NPR's Brenda Salinas reports, it also has an invisible feature that could help Democrats mine data from users.
It's the first app you see when you open the iTunes store. Inauguration 2013. The welcome page asks for your phone number. Below that, a link to terms and services. You can skip both and go straight to the features.
It's actually a really good-looking app. I mean, it does seem useful.
That's Jason Brookman. He's the director of consumer privacy for the nonprofit Center of Democracy and Technology. He likes the app's features, but not its terms of service. That link, the one most users probably ignore, takes you to a document on the committee's website. And it's the website that opens up a loophole for Brookman.
So it says, we may collect email addresses and cell phone data and, you know, your location information, and we reserve the right to sell that to or give it to other candidates and to use it in ways you may not necessarily expect when you're just trying to install an application to figure out where to go on Inauguration Day.
The Presidential Inaugural Committee would not comment publicly, but it did defend its app in a statement, saying it had no way to collect emails, names, or other personal information. It also defended the terms of service on its website, saying it's appropriate for a president's inaugural committee to support and reflect their party's ideals and causes. And that's a problem, says Brookman. The app links to services like Facebook, Twitter, and its own website, where the rules aren't so clear.
If you go to a different service, privacy policy does reserve pretty broad rights to do lots of stuff with that.
Stuff that's catching the attention of both parties. Dan Morgan is a GOP fundraising consultant. While he doesn't like the idea of data mining apps, he says we'll be seeing more of them from Democrats and Republicans.
We're a pack of dogs in this business. Whatever one does, the other one wants to quickly follow. And I can guarantee Republicans are out there looking at what the Democrats are doing and saying, hey, how do we do the same thing?
Morgan predicts a future where political groups mine more data than Google. Campaigns will make special apps for town halls and public appearances, and then the data will be mined for fundraising. To him, this is just the tip of the iceberg. Brenda Salinas, NPR News.
The Presidential Inaugural Committee might have its first ever smartphone app, but for the hundreds of thousands of onlookers who flooded the National Mall today, there were plenty of other reasons to be clutching a mobile device. As NPR's Elsa Chang reports, many of them just wanted to say, "We came."
All you need to do is look at Tommy Alter's iPhone case, and you can tell right away who he voted for. It's emblazoned with the red, white, and blue campaign logo of President Obama. Even the button on the bottom of his iPhone is wearing its own Obama logo. Alter is a senior at George Washington University, and he's standing near the Washington Monument, posting photos on Instagram with his friends.
Probably all done one.
This is a multiple Instagram. This is probably a two-a-day for sure.
No, this is probably four or five, honestly.
With Alter are Austin Wender and Alex Griffith. They all say, yeah, the people at the Capitol look like tiny ants from this distance, and yeah, what we're seeing on the Jumbotron is probably what we'd be watching on TV anyway if we were at home. But Wender says today is about telling the world, look at me, I was here.
It's so other people can live vicariously through my amazing life, seriously.
The inauguration of 2013 is the smartphone inauguration. The website for the congressional committee in charge of the inauguration used GPS technology to direct ticket holders to their seats. And even the Secret Service was tweeting up a storm about street closures and parade routes. But it was hard to find anyone using any of that. Mostly people were just using their phones as public diaries, like Evelyn Quinn.
No regular cameras, no pen and paper. Just our phones, and we don't even think we're going to make phone calls. It's purely for documentation.
Of course, part of that documentation means reporting on the reporters themselves. Tommy Alter and his friends asked me to pose with them for their latest Instagram photo. Alter starts pounding out the photo caption with his thumbs.
Chilling with Elsa Chang from hashtag NPR, and then maybe just say, great times, something like that. No, not great time. Not great time.
Not great.
Not great. Not great. Not great. No, we did have a great time, but yeah, that sounds like
chilling on the grass. That sounds kind of weird.
I called Alter on the phone a little while after that. He informed me that group photo on Instagram had already received dozens of likes, and someone had posted a comment that read, "I love your life." Elsa Chang, NPR News, on the National Mall.